We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app. This is WTIC's Law Talk, a project of the Hartford County Bar Association. If you have a legal question, call now, 860-522-WTIC or 800-966-WTIC. And now, it's time for Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Law Talk right here on WTIC News Talk 1080, WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. I am Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. My pleasure and my privilege to host these Saturday afternoon get-togethers. Just wanted to let you know that this is your legal interactive toolbox. Our job is to take your calls, field your emails, and give you some legal advice, legal information, try to help you navigate your way through that thicket of laws and rules and regulations that, whether we like it or not, we're all bound by. So we do that on Saturday afternoons from 3 until 4, and we welcome your phone calls at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC. If your device favors digits over letters, that translates to 9842. So that's 1-800-966-9842, 860-522-9842. You can email us also. The email is my name. It's john.matulis, M-A-T-U-L-I-S, at entercom.com. And if you email us, we will answer your email in the future. And if you've emailed us, we'll assume that we have permission to answer your email on the air so that we can benefit others at the same time. Before we get started today, just wanted to remind you, this is one of those magical weekends where the time changes. So yes, this time tomorrow, it will be daylight savings time or Eastern daylight time. 24 hours from now, it'll be 25 hours later. So don't forget to set your clocks, turn them ahead because it's spring. So spring ahead, fall back. And that's what we'll do to keep you aware of the time changes and what's going on. So let me tell you a little bit about what we have planned for today. We've got a bunch of different topics. Some of these are based on listener emails. Some of them are follow-ups on previous topics we've talked about. We're going to visit the world of personal injury law. And in particular, we're going to talk about a defense which is sometimes used in certain cases called a sudden emergency defense. And this is sort of interesting stuff. And if you find yourself in a situation where you've either been rear-ended or your car has done the rear-ending, this may come up. So we'll talk about that. We'll explain it. We'll talk about a recent case from the New London Judicial District where this was tried, and the judge's decision dealt with it, and we'll tell you whether it worked and why. Okay? We'll also get into some listener emails. There's one in particular that I'd love to talk to you about, and I'm going to do that. It involves someone who gets tip income and an employer who takes the waitstaff tips from the staff where she works. So that's one we're going to spend a little bit of time on because we think that's going to help some folks that are listening. And if you're an employer and you're doing this stuff, you better listen up also, okay? Previously, we had talked about family law, and in particular, one of the areas that seems to resonate with some of our demographic for our listening audience, that is grandparent visitation. And we had talked about just how difficult the courts have made it for grandparents to get court-ordered visitation with their grandchildren when the biological parents object. Well, we're going to talk about a case where the grandparents did get that visitation and some of the problems that they encountered thereafter, because it has not been completely smooth sailing. And so we'll tell you some issues, we'll tell you what the court did about it, and we'll tell you what we think is the takeaway for all of that. Okay, got a couple of other topics. There are a couple of court cases that stand in stark contrast to how they came out. So we'll put these into a segment that we're going to put a label on called Equal Justice? ? So we'll talk about that. One of them involves a 23-year-old from Florida, and the other one involves a tenured law school professor from the University of Minnesota School of Law. We'll tell you what happened to each of these two individuals, and you can decide for yourself whether equal justice was meted out or not. Also, if we have time, we're going to get into a topic that a couple of people have spoken to me about during the week, and it has to do with people selling real estate, especially when the real estate, and these are residential single-family homes, are priced in a range where they're sort of in the target for first-time homebuyers. And it has to do with the topic of intentionally inflated purchase prices. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about what that is. And so you'll have an idea, if you're in this situation, what to expect, how to deal with it, and a couple of things to watch out for that your realtor may not remember to tell you about. So that is the agenda for today. Our phone number is 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. The email address is john.matulis, that's my last name, M as in Michael, A-T-U-L-I-S, at entercom.com. Sorry about that, boss. Okay, so that's what we're going to be doing, and I thought it might be a good idea to start off with the business about personal injury. Now, this particular case comes out of the New London Judicial District, and a nice lady named Marie was driving down the road, and this was a two-lane highway, and a car driven by a lady named Bethany, who happened to be a state employee, was coming towards her in the opposite direction. Bethany's car suddenly goes out of control. It swerves into Marie's lane, and it hits Marie head on. So this is the story of the trial of the case, and in particular, the fact that Bethany's attorneys raised as a defense what is called sudden emergency. So let's tell you some of the facts of this case, and let's tell you how the court dealt with it, okay? By the way, Bethany happened to be a state employee, and she was driving a car in the course of her employment with the Department of Administrative Services. However, that doesn't matter, because for purposes of our discussion, the principle is all the same. Okay, so they're driving down the road, they collide, and in Bethany's behalf, her lawyers claim that there should be no judgment against her because of sudden emergency. Well, what does that mean? Let me tell you the facts that the judge found. This case was tried to the court and not to a jury, so we've got a written decision in which the judge laid out her findings of fact, her legal conclusions, and her reasoning. So what they testified to and what the judge found was that Bethany was driving down the road. She did not know her speed at the time that her car collided with Marie's car. Before the impact, she heard a pop-like sound, and the car pulled to the right. The court found she did not know her speed at the time. She could not recall whether she had even applied her brakes. She did not know how far she was from Marie's vehicle. The investigating police officer responded to the incident and testified that he observed a tear in the left front tire sidewall, and wrote that it, quote, appeared to have blown out, close quote. There is the sudden emergency upon which Bethany and her attorneys relied. Tires suddenly blew out, lost control. Well, the court had trouble with that, okay? First of all, the sudden emergency doctrine based on unavoidable accident is something that comes out of a 1976 Connecticut Supreme Court case, But in that case, the unavoidable accident defense applied because the operator of the vehicle had a sudden medical emergency, which resulted in the loss of control of the vehicle. In this case here, we've got apparently a rip in the tire sidewall, okay? So the court in this case in New London refused to expand that to include a tire failure for several reasons. Number one, there was no claim of a sudden medical emergency, so the existing case law did not apply. And second, the court found the plaintiff had proved that the operator of the state vehicle, Bethany, was negligent in her operation. So how'd the court get there? Well, let's look at some of those facts that the court found as part of the opinion. Not only did she not know all these details, she testified that the car swerved to the right after she heard the pop. Well, she ended up in the other vehicle lane, and that means that she would have driven to the left. So even if the failure of that tire did cause a sudden emergency, it shouldn't have caused her to end up in the left-hand lane when it caused her, by her own testimony, to pull to the right. So what is the takeaway on this? There is a doctrine called sudden emergency or unavoidable accident. Right now, it's limited to medical emergencies. Somebody has a heart attack, a stroke, something like that. That's a valid defense. But in this case here, the takeaway was that all of the other factors, which the court found, suggested that the failure of the tire had little or nothing to do with the cause of the accident, that it was Bethany's negligence. So that is the story on that. We're going to be back with Law Talk, but first we've got to take a break. I'm Attorney John Matulis, and I'm happy to hear from you at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. We're here until 4 o'clock. Better to give us a call earlier rather than later so that we'll have an opportunity to give your call the best attention that we can. So let's take a break and make a buck. Okay, welcome back to Law Talk on a sunny Saturday afternoon, the very end of the winter season. As Mr. Announcer Man reminded you, this is the time when we set our clocks ahead 1 hour because it's spring. A little bit of help from Chicago. They're reminding us that does anybody really know what time it is? So sometime between the time most of us would be going to bed tonight and the time we wake up tomorrow, it turns into 1 hour ahead. So 24 hours from now, it's really 25 hours later. Don't forget. Wanted to talk to you a little bit more about this really interesting email from Emily in Ellington. In the meantime, just wanted to let you know that if you've got a legal question, legal issue, something you want to be heard about of a legal matter, not political or not partisan, but legal, give us a call at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. That's toll-free from anywhere in the continental U.S. Happy to help you out. Just give us a call so we can give you some information and in the process help our listeners also. So here's the email from Emily in Ellington. Attorney M, I am a waitress slash cashier in a small family-owned pizza shop. We have table service and carry-out business. Every customer pays their bill at the register. At the register is a big jar labeled tips in great big letters. Most all of our customers who tip put cash in the jar, even the table service guests. Well, every night after we close, the two brothers who own the place take all the tip money for themselves, and they buy beers and lottery tickets with it. We get nothing. I'm fed up. What can I do? P.S. Please don't use my real name or town on the air. And Emily, which is not her real name, and Ellington, which is not her real town, thank you for calling, and I'm sorry for your situation. So this is a really interesting email, and let me see what we can do to help out Emily. First of all, we don't know, Emily, if you're being paid the statutory tip rate, hourly wage, or you're being paid at or above the minimum hourly wage. You did mention that you were a waitress slash cashier, and that may put you into a category that's a little bit ambiguous. The tip rate is nearly $4 an hour lower than the current minimum wage here in Connecticut because of the assumption that tip staff, wait staff who earn tips make it up and then some. So the first thing I'd recommend is that you consider reporting this to the Connecticut Department of Labor, the Wage and Hour Division. Now, the business about the minimum rate, if you're being paid the $10.10 per hour minimum rate, this becomes a little bit tougher of a question. However, the fact that the owners of the company are taking this money for themselves, it becomes revenue. And I will bet you a nice lunch anywhere you can think of that they are not reporting this as part of their revenue for tax purposes. It's clearly income to them, and therefore it should be included, and it probably is not. They are sort of in a bullseye because businesses like pizza shops, where large amounts of their revenue are paid in the form of cash currency, are always suspected of understating their income. And even when the auditors try to match up things like the amount of flour they've purchased and the number of pizzas it would make versus the revenue, they can always claim spoilage or other things like that, which justify lower revenue being reported than the amount of ingredients consumed might suggest. So in this case here, I think that another alternative would be to contact the Department of Revenue Services and let them know this is going on. But for your sake, I think that it's probably time to start thinking about another job, okay? That's the practical, pragmatic advice. You describe this as a small business. It's family-owned. Let's talk about what they can do or not do in the event that you go through with this and they get wind of it, okay? Now, they can fire you. They cannot legally fire you for basically doing a duty of reporting this kind of information. There's a long, long line of cases in Connecticut that involve the doctrine that's called wrongful discharge. And they go all the way back to a case in the mid-70s or the late 70s called Sheets versus Teddy's Frosted Foods. And what it says is that if you're fired for basically carrying out a civic duty or you have a public obligation to do that, that you're entitled to the compensation you lost and all of the other stuff involved. So they're not supposed to be able to legally fire you. The second thing is you may fit into the category of a whistleblower, but I have to tell you that in both of these categories, this involves litigation in courts, and there may be attorneys who would be willing to pursue this. One of the things I'm going to suggest, if it goes that direction, contact the lawyer referral service, and you can get in touch with a labor lawyer, an employment lawyer, who can tell you a lot more about this and can tell you whether you're going to be able to interest an attorney to take the case. They are expensive, they are time-consuming, and depending on how it plays out, they may not be able to get attorney's fees or costs from the employer if you win. So overall, sort of a difficult situation. Shame on these employers. The fact that they're not only taking the money for themselves, but then they're using it for, as you put it, for beers and lottery tickets, just seems to be even more of a reason why they need to stop doing this. So I'm going to urge you to take some steps, but to protect yourself, you know, start checking out the job market, because this type of thing may very well bring an end to your job. And while you may have legal remedies, as a practical matter, you may or may not end up pursuing them. So thanks for an interesting email. And I suspect that you're not alone in a situation like this, nor are these two brothers who run the pizza joint the only ones who are doing things like this to the detriment of their employees. So thanks for an interesting email. We're going to have to break for new sports and weather, and then more of Law Talk right after this. Law Yes, it did. Welcome back to Law Talk, everybody. It's phase two of our Saturday afternoon legal interactive toolbox. I'm attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. We're going to be with you up until 4 o'clock, and we're dispensing information, advice. We've got some tidbits and some vignettes about legal matters that we think you'll find of interest. And we always welcome your phone calls at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. Do not forget to turn your clocks ahead this evening, because when you wake up tomorrow, it's going to be an hour later. 24 hours from now, it's going to be 25 hours later. This is the time in the show, before we get back to some of the listener calls and emails and some of the material that we're going to share with you, that I have to remind you that if you don't have an attorney and you have a legal issue or are looking for legal information, the best alternative is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. Now, please don't hire a lawyer off a billboard or off the internet or what the person on the bar stool next to you said was a great outcome for them. Okay, the thing to do is to contact them at the phone number that I'm going to give you in a moment. And here's what will happen. They'll ask you a few questions to determine the specific nature of your legal issue. You will then get referred to an attorney who is experienced, who is insured, who is free of disciplinary entanglements, and who practices in the appropriate subject areas to help you out. That's who they refer you to. So what do you get? Well, you get a half-hour consult with that attorney. It's either in his or her office, or it's over the telephone. That's up to the two of you. If you expect them to review any documents, it's best to get them to them in advance so they can look at it before you actually have the conference. So what does all this cost? Well, a lot of you are aware that attorneys often bill by the billable hour, and experienced attorneys, the rates are significant. Well, you get a half-hour consult for $35. That's it. On top of that, if you call them regarding your personal injury claim, they will waive the $35 fee. You've got a Social Security disability claim and you need help with it, they will waive the $35 fee. You're injured and it's an injury at work, so it's a workers' comp claim. That's another injury for which they will waive the $35 fee. Now, at the end of that half hour, there's no further obligation. There's no hard sell. And if you and the attorney are done with each other, they'll wish you well, and that's the end of it. If you want further legal assistance or services, well, that's up to you and the attorney to discuss and decide between yourselves whether any further services are going to be rendered or not. So how do you access them? You access them by phoning them at 860-525-6052. That's 860-525-6052. That is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. That small little $35 fee underwrites a portion of the administrative expenses for rent and telephones and office personnel in order to operate the service, and it is a good deal. That is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service at 860-525-6052. And tell them you heard about it on Law Talk. Okay, so getting back to some of the material that I promised we'd be discussing when we started off today, you might remember that a few shows ago we talked about grandparent visitation and how under Connecticut the law has made it quite difficult for grandparents to be awarded court-ordered visitation with their grandchildren. This comes up in a number of different settings. One of them is that the parents of the child or the children, one of them is out of the picture. Sometimes they've died, sometimes they're incarcerated, and the other parent is the one who has custody. The grandparents have to show a parent-like relationship and some evidence of imminent harm to the child in the event that they're not allowed visitation or custody. So it's very difficult, and we talked about a case where that had been denied. So now we're going to do one that's going to be a little bit more encouraging. This one has to do with a case where the grandparents actually were granted visitation previously, and what happened when they did so. Okay, this involves Brandon, who is age 7, and his mom died in March of 2016, okay, nearly 4 years ago, out of a drug overdose. Brandon lives with his father, and with the father is also Brandon's half-sister. Now, back in November of 2016, mom's parents petitioned for and actually received a visitation order where they could visit with Brandon, and the court ordered a specific visitation schedule. Okay. Well, dad went to court. He wants to modify that schedule, and he wants to add some conditions and changes. So let me tell you what dad wanted to do. Let me tell you what the parents wanted in response, and tell you what the court did and why. Okay. First of all, he wanted to reduce the visitation time. No good reason given. He wanted for them to have no contact with the maternal aunt. That was the late mother's sister. Now, she happened to live with the grandparents, so that would have been a tremendous burden on them and have a big negative impact on visitation. He wanted Brandon to have no contact with his 9-year-old half-sister. He wanted Brandon, when he was with the grandparents, to consume no fast food, minimal refined sugar. He wanted to make sure that Brandon had no exposure to drugs and alcohol. Sounds reasonable. And he wanted to make sure that there would be no babysitters during visitation, and that if the grandparents were unable to watch the child themselves, then they were to waive the visitation. And he said he wanted Brandon taken to no church or other place of worship. So here's what the court did, going down the list, and we'll see what we can cipher out of this that's going to be helpful. Okay, first of all, with respect to reducing the visitation time, the court said, no, it continues to be guided by the best interests of the child. And in this case, the court concluded that it was in Brandon's best interest to continue to have close contact with his late mom's parents, his grandparents. So that's the reasoning for that one. The business about no contact with the maternal aunt, who just happened to live with the grandparents, court denied that, said, we don't care if you don't get along with her. That's just impractical. You're not going to have that restriction. No contact with the 9-year-old half-sister, same thing, denied. They said there's evidence that they enjoyed each other's company. Don't be silly. The business about no fast food and minimal refined sugar, well, the court denied those, not because of any disagreement, but because they said that that is micromanaging the visitation. Now, the requirement the father had, that he wanted the order changed so that there would be no exposure of Brandon to drugs or alcohol, here's what the court did, which is pretty interesting. The court agreed, and it said that that was now part of the order, except Brandon could still be taken to sporting events or other activities where the grandparents would have no control over the activities of third parties with respect to purchasing alcohol or things of that nature. So, interesting way to deal with that. The business about no babysitters during visitation, if the grandparents weren't going to be available, they couldn't have it. The court said, yep, that's correct. And the last one, no church or other place of worship. The court agreed with the father and said that that would be the order. So some of this shows a respect for the biological parent, even though some of the requests that were made seemed to be pretty limiting. There is a strong preference that the biological parents have much to say with the raising of the child. Some of the rest of it showed a good compromise between what the father wanted and what the grandparents wanted to do. And overall, it basically showed that it's difficult to balance the equities, and it's an example of the difficulty that judges have in family court dealing with all of these different issues. I don't think there was a single person involved in this case about whom it could be said they did not mean well for Brandon, but they had disagreements among themselves nonetheless, and that is the way the court chose to deal with that. Our phone number is 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. Only here until 4 o'clock. Better to hear from you sooner than later. Next up, Susan in Granby. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, Susan. You're on Law Talk.
Yes. I have a question for you regarding living trusts.
Okay.
We all, or what we have been able to, or what we've been advised so far, the living trust is a good way to go. You can avoid probate court, a lot of fees, a lot of entanglements, and so forth when it comes to family planning. I guess the question is it can be rather expensive to do it. Obviously, you have an initial fee up front to discuss it with a lawyer, usually, I guess, about an hour. And then there is following up, obviously, the work that's put into once they have all of your assets and all of your information and so forth and so on. And then there are there's execution of paperwork, which apparently most times, in other words, the paperwork that will legally put this living trust into the work or into the works. Would you have a general number as to what one might have to? I know it's about $400, $450 for the initial hour consultation, if you will. And then what would be, with a normal estate, we're not talking millions and millions of dollars, but general, with your paperwork and everything put together, what kind of expense would that be?
Okay, Susan, those are excellent questions, and I'm going to answer them in a little different order than you asked them because I think it's helpful for a lot of our listeners to hear some of this. The first question anybody who is considering a living trust should ask themselves is, what do I expect to accomplish with this? Now, here's the reason why. Some people figure, well, it's going to save me money. Well, it's not going to save any taxes because the most common form of living trust is what's called a revocable living trust, and that is tax neutral. You can take and put all of your assets into a revocable living trust, die the next day, and your estate will be treated as if those assets were still owned in your own name. So that's one thing that people need to understand. Another common reason people do it, and this is something you alluded to, was, well, avoiding probate and so on. You can avoid the assets going through the probate process. However, their existence, their value, and all the details still have to be disclosed in the form of what's called a CT 706 tax return. And therefore, whether people like it or not, the probate court is still going to have its hooks into this estate, even if a revocable trust has been used. Now, people sometimes have other reasons. For example, somebody may have a very strong feeling about privacy. They know that their inventory of their decedent's estate is usually a public document. And if that's very troubling to them, using a revocable trust will keep assets that are properly put into the trust from showing up inside the inventory. But it's not going to change the disposition of that. Now, you asked a question about what all this costs. Here's the way to deal with that. First of all, we're all aware that there are people out there that in return for a brunch or an afternoon coffee and dessert or an evening program will put seminars on explaining all the benefits and so on. What we tell people, and I've had probate judges who have been guests on this program before and asked them, what do you tell people? And the answer usually is, number one, if you have a lawyer already whom you're comfortable with, contact him or her and say, I'm interested in this. If you cannot help me, will you refer me to someone who can? Just remember that the people that advertise the most extensively, that have the great big ads in the Hartford Courant or the internet stuff, somebody's got to pay for that great big advertising budget. And they're not absorbing that out of their profit margins. Those costs are being passed on one way or another.
Right.
And then when you talk to an attorney who does this type of work, even before you talk to them, you might say up front, how do you do this? Is there a flat fee? Am I charged by the hour? What is the hourly rate? And most of them will be willing to explain that to you in advance, and they should have you sign an agreement up front that spells all of this out in great detail, because avoiding confusion or surprises is in the best interests of both sides.
Yeah.
We're going to have to take a break for a minute, but I'd like you, if I have some more to answer for you, to ask you if you'd hold on, and we'll pick up with you on the backside of the break.
Yes, I appreciate that.
Thanks. Thank you. Hold on, Susan. It's a great question. Okay, and we'll be back with more of Law Talk after this. All right, well, Excellent choice, Michael. Bumping us back into Law Talk right here. Time has come today, and don't forget to set your clocks ahead for tomorrow morning. We're talking to Susan and Granby, and Susan, before the break, we were talking about some questions you had regarding living trusts. So I started off on a little bit of a lecture about that and finally got back to the question you were asking, which had more to do with the costs about those trusts. So let me add one more paragraph and then see if I've answered that or see if we can help you a little bit further, okay? The last paragraph is that there are no set fees on all of this. Some lawyers have much greater expense and overhead than do others. Some of them will charge fees that may be more reasonable. But for people who do this kind of work, unless you have a particularly complex situation, you may be perfectly fine with a Chevrolet version of a revocable trust. You may not need the Rolls-Royce version. So at this point, Susan, let me stop and see if I've answered your question or how we can discuss this a little bit further to help you and to help our listeners.
Sure. All right, two more questions. One would be, as I understand, there is, you set, let's just say that you've decided to go ahead, you're comfortable with your lawyer, you understand the fees, but the fee that I believe is normally different or separate from setting this up, I think it's called execution of documents or something to make sure this all processes through. Have I got that correct?
Well, there's a period where there's an event where the client has to sign the documents. She's going to sign as the settlor or the trustor. Typically, she's often the first trustee, so she would sign in that capacity also. But that's basically signing documents which should have been pre-reviewed and pre-approved in advance. I suspect you might be talking about actually funding the revocable trust. And this is a really, really touchy area because we've had clients in our office, in my private practice, who have gone to some of these seminars and paid a lot of money for revocable trusts that come in a beautiful leather-like binder. And I say, okay, is it all set to go? Well, yeah, it's all set to go, but they said that they're not going to transfer any assets into it. So the key to this, because the trust is nothing other than an empty vessel until assets are transferred into it, is if you're going to put real estate into it, there have to be deeds drawn and executed and recorded on the land records. If there are securities that are going to go into it, that all has to be transferred properly. Whatever the assets are that are going into it, the transfer has to be worked out. So I'm wondering if that might be what you're referring to, because
that is exactly what I'm talking about.
Ah, okay.
Exactly, living trust documents. And that is how you, yes, it's the transfer of those actual documents. So you've set it all up, you know what you want to do and so on, but now there has to be an execution of transfer.
Okay, my view is, first of all, I'm confident that there is no set fee for this. This is what the market will bear. Somebody says it's $450. Someone else says it's $750. Someone else says that I'm only going to charge you for the time that we spend. And if we spend a half hour, you pay for 1/2 hour of my billable time. All of those fee models are acceptable as long as it's something that has been told to you in advance and that you've agreed to. These are never bad times to be an aggressive consumer and ask questions, and don't necessarily have to go with the first attorney with whom you speak, especially if the prices might seem a little bit rich to you. Get a feel for a couple of them and see who you feel comfortable with and what they're charging.
Right. Okay. All right. That's very good. Generally speaking, I am a very well-educated buyer of many things, and that's why I wanted to look into this. All right. I have one other question.
Go for it.
Basically speaking, I have heard that someone else who went through, and I guess apparently they were working with a lawyer that they liked and they had been comfortable with, I guess some other family member had used them and they were fine. There was a very long document, many pages of obviously answering a lot of questions, all the typical type of information, the name and the address and social security numbers and asset listing and children and so forth and so on. Some of the questions they felt to be rather intrusive, things like, are people drinking in the family? Does anybody have a drug habit? A lot of things that apparently did not believe were appropriate to their objective, which was to obviously formulate this thing and hopefully leave the things in good order. Have you heard that that's what they do? do. They can ask a lot of rather intrusive things.
Okay, excellent question. So let me tell you what I think was going on in that case. First of all, a lot of lawyers use questionnaires and they ask the clients to complete them. Why? Number one, it's more accurate than the lawyer listening and writing notes because he or she can make a mistake or miss something or misunderstand something. Number two, it forces the client to think a little more thoroughly than just conversing with somebody who's taking things down. But number three, there are certain areas where if you're planning someone's estate, you might want to know, is there someone in the family who might be a beneficiary who may have some special needs? Is there somebody who's been through bankruptcy or who is chronically being chased by creditors? Is there somebody who is battling with substance abuse? Because there are different ways to deal with bequests or trust distributions to individuals that fit into those categories. So I suspect that the general area of inquiry was for the purposes I mentioned, but it was probably handled in a pretty clumsy and a not very tactful or sensitive fashion. Do you think that might be it?
Yeah, if none of the things actually applied, you know, you don't have any of those problems or anything, I guess in theory, in working with the lawyer, you just say, I'm not comfortable responding to this kind of thing. We don't have any problems. But, you know, it just seemed to me from the way they did it, they were a little, they felt that it wasn't true.
Yeah. Well, I think a good thing to say would be, why are you asking me this? But Susan, that's a great question. So thanks for letting us discuss it. And that music in the background is my cue to say I've got to say goodbye. So I'm saying goodbye. And thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye now. Okay, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon. For those of you that have been listening, thanks for sticking with us and giving us an opportunity to share some information with you. For my top-notch producer, Mike Oko, thanks for trying to make us sound good. It is a never-ending struggle. I'm attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. We are here these Saturday afternoons, and as we say around here, we will see you next Saturday. Take care.
Law Talk is presented as a public service by the Hartford County Bar Association. Its content is intended to be educational and informative, but is not considered to be formal legal opinion. If you want or need a formal legal opinion upon which to rely in decision-making, please consider formally engaging an attorney to review all relevant facts in detail and examine the pertinent law as it applies to those facts. A solid opinion means better decisions. The views expressed during this program are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Hartford County Bar Association, its officers, or its directors.